Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's October 27th, 2017 program, Examining Income Inequality in Oregon, the income gap separating the average working family from the highest paid earners is widening in Oregon. This is our eighth program in our 2017-2018 programming year. I'm Sandra Bishop, City Club President. The club brings together civic-minded people to make Eugene a better place to live, work, and play. We are a member-supported nonprofit. Our members have a direct influence on public policy. Become a member of City Club at cityclubofeugene.org. Support for City Club is provided by our members and supporters, including Sacred Earth Botanicals, U of O Government and Community Relations, and one of our Sapphire sponsors, George Rohde Repair Shops, providing car care with a conscience, with three repair locations in Eugene, Euro Asian Automotive, Stadium Automotive, and Auto House, or online at eugenerepairs.com. Special thanks to PacInfo Internet Solutions and KLCC Radio. City Club programs are broadcast on public radio station KLCC 89.7 at 6:30 on Mondays following the program. The coordinator for today's program is Sandy Erickson. We want to thank Sandy for organizing this important topic and speaker today. Thank you. And now I'd like to turn it over to Sandy Erickson to introduce our speaker.
Good afternoon, everyone. In his State of the Union address in 2012, President Obama, describing income inequality, called it the defining issue of our time. And since then, it has become an even greater social and economic problem. Mr. Ordonez, our speaker today, calls it eye-popping, and it is. No one should think that income inequality refers to everyone earning the same. It refers to how evenly or unevenly income and subsequent wealth is distributed in our society. It hits many of us in the gut, meaning as what is just plain fair or not fair. So just how eye-popping is the problem? According to the World Bank, the most popular measure of inequality is called the Gini coefficient. Using that coefficient, the United States ranks below many nations, including Iran, Uganda, Nigeria, Russia, Nicaragua, Vietnam, and Mongolia, to name a few. In fact, 70% of all the countries in the world have more equal income distribution than the United States, whether they are rich or poor. Such disproportionate income distribution destabilizes our economy, divides and holds people back, segregates housing, generates homelessness and poverty, polarizes our politics, stratifies our society into a caste system, and prevents the treatment of health problems. Inequality and poverty among children are a special moral disgrace. The gender pay gap is also found to be higher in more unequal societies, as is the rate of environmental damage. The Oregon Center for Public Policy is Oregon's leading nonpartisan economic research organization. They inform lawmakers, the public, educational institutions, and business groups on current and accurate financial fact, and their reports are available at ocpp.org. Presenting their latest research on income inequality in Oregon is Communications Director Juan Carlos Ordonez. Upon his graduation from Harvard Law School in 1995, Juan Carlos Ordonez practiced commercial complex litigation in New York City, leaving 6 years later to return to Guatemala, where he worked on the sustainable development of indigenous communities. Mr. Ordonez also has worked as a journalist for English and Spanish language publications. and he had joined the Oregon Center for Public Policy in 2007. We're privileged to have him here. Join me in welcoming Juan Carlos Ordóñez.
Thank you, Sandy, for that great introduction, and thanks to the City Club for inviting me to speak here today and for focusing on the issue of income inequality. You know, 6 years ago, just a few blocks from where we're gathered here today, several thousand folks gathered to protest greed and economic injustice. And that was the Occupy movement that began in New York City in 2011, in the fall of 2011, and spread nationwide, and it arrived in Oregon in October of 2011. And the Occupy movement managed at least one great success, and that was putting the issue of income inequality squarely on the national agenda in people's minds. Those of us who had been working in think tanks and in academia had long been raising the alarm about rising income inequality, but it really was the Occupy movement that finally made the phrase the top 1% a household phrase. And as Sandy noted, it also led to one occupant of the White House, President Obama, to point out that income inequality is the defining challenge of our time. It is certainly the biggest economic issue facing our nation. And ever since the Occupy movement, there's been a lot more research coming out and discussion about the damaging effects of income inequality. Sandy has already pointed some out. Certainly, we know from the research that income inequality stifles social mobility, the ability of a kid born at the lower rungs to rise to the top. There's research that has shown that there's a linkage between mortality and income inequality. So folks at the lower rungs of the income ladder are dying at a younger age than those at the top. Findings that income inequality leads to lower economic growth. There's just been a lot of research in terms of the damaging effects and just the problem that it causes. That said, for all that greater awareness about income inequality, its full dimensions, we actually have done very little to confront the problem. And that's what the data shows. And we at the Oregon Center for Public Policy published a paper just this month with the most recently available data on income inequality in Oregon. So today I'm going to be providing an overview, sort of the key findings of our paper, while also talking about how it is that we got to this place of such stark differences between the top and the rest, as well as mention some ideas on how we can move forward here in Oregon in confronting this challenge. As Sandy said, our paper is available on our website, ocpp.org, as is all of our research. So I invite you all to check out our website. But let's move on and talk about what the data says. And I should say that the data that I'm going to be describing is data supplied by the Oregon Department of Revenue. So I'm talking about tax data. And the most recently available data is for tax year 2015. The data for 2016 won't be available until next year, so we'll be crunching it then. But the 2015 is the most recently available data. And let me just point out that all the figures that I'm going to be referencing have been adjusted for inflation, in case you're wondering, and in case I failed to point it out. Okay, so let me focus on three sort of top-level findings from our paper. The first one is that never has the gap separating the middle and the very rich been as wide in Oregon as it was in 2015. By very rich, I mean the richest 0.1%. You can think about it as the richest one in every 1,000 Oregonians. And that very small group at the top had average incomes in 2015 of $4.3 million. And that was a record high. But it's not just the total amount of dollars that this group is bringing in that was at a record. It's also how far apart that group has pulled away from the middle. So in the year 1980, and that's when our data series begins, so that's why I say 1980. But in 1980, it took 26 median income workers, and the median income is the income of the Oregonian right in the middle of the income ladder. So it took 26 median income workers to equal the income of the average member of the top 0.1%. In 2015, that ratio had jumped to 126. Again, and that was a record high. Never has it been that high since our data goes back to 1980. So as I said, that's one key takeaway from our report, that gap has never been as wide as it was in 2015. A second point to highlight from our report is how the top 1% is doing. And that, of course, the 1% is the richest one out of every 100 Oregonians. And the top 1% is not at a record high, but not far from a record high. They're actually doing still fabulously well. Since 1980, the average income for this group has basically tripled. In the meantime, the median income, again, the Oregonian in the middle, has barely budged. If you look at it in a chart, what you see for the median income in Oregon from 1980 to 2015, it looks like a flat line, because over time you can barely notice the very small increase. Another way that you can think about the magnitude of the income going to the top 1% in Oregon is that group, the top 1%, in 2015 garnered more income than the entire bottom half of all Oregonians, the lowest earning half. Again, the top 1% took in more income than the bottom half of Oregonians. That just gives you a sense of how wide income inequality is in our state. The third point I want to highlight from our paper is that it's the difference in incomes. It's not just one of the total amount of dollars that are coming in. It's not just the total amount of money that sets those at the top apart. It's also the type of income that's flowing to the top that's different, the different sources of income. So one way to think about it is that for your typical Oregonian, your middle-class Oregonians or lower-income Oregonians, all or nearly all of their income is going to come from a paycheck. But that's not at all the case for those at the top. For those at the top, more than half of their income is coming from owning assets, capital assets, or owning businesses. Just to give you a sense of that, is by looking at capital gains income. And capital income is the income that you earn when you sell assets such as bonds, stocks, and real estate for a profit. And in Oregon, in 2015, 60% of all capital gains income flowed to those to the top 1%. 40%, a full 40%, flowed to the top 0.1%. Again, this sliver of Oregonians at the top took in 40% of all capital gains income. So a vast difference in the sources of income going from those to the middle as opposed to those at the top. Now, one last point I want to make about the state of income inequality, I should say, is not in our report, because there's not good state-level data on it, but it's well worth pointing it out. And that is that as extreme as income inequality is, wealth inequality is even more extreme. Wealth refers to basically your net worth, what you're left with after you add up all your assets and liabilities. And wealth inequality is even more concentrated at the top of the income ladder. So how do we get here? How do we get to this situation of such an extreme imbalance between those at the top and the rest? One thing is certain, and that is that it did not happen by accident. It happened as a result of public policy choices made over many decades. Some of you probably know firsthand that there was a time in our nation's history when we had a much more robust and secure middle class. And that period was the post-war period, from the mid-1940s through the mid-1970s. And in this time, there was greater social mobility. The benefits of the economy were being shared much more broadly. Although I should note that I don't want to paint too rosy a picture of this time period, because while we did have a much more robust middle class, that middle class purposely left out people of color. And the effects of that exclusion are being felt to this day. But nevertheless, There was in place at that time economic structures that nurtured a strong and secure middle class. So for example, and some of the drivers of that, some of the factors that account for that, some of the structures that create that nurture that middle class, are fairly obvious. We had back then much greater levels of workers joining unions. The unionization rate was much higher. And unions ensure that that the benefits produced by the economy were shared more broadly in the way of higher wages. It's not really an exaggeration to say that unions built the middle class. Back then, we also had a much more progressive tax structure, especially at the federal level. During the Dwight Eisenhower period, for example, most of the 1950s, the top marginal tax rate in our country was 91%. Today, it's under 40%. Also, back then, we had public structures that created economic opportunity for folks. Strong and vibrant, strong public structures that really allowed for social mobility. To me, one of the stories that sort of illustrates this point is the story of Andy Grove. And if you don't know, that name doesn't ring a bell. Andy Grove was one of the founders of Intel. And he was also the CEO of the company during the period when it grew to become the technology giant that it is today. And Andy Grove, in 1997, took out a full-page ad in the New York Times to thank his alma mater, the City College of New York. And the ad reads, "In 1957, I arrived as a refugee from Hungary. 3 days later, barely able to understand English, I took the subway up to City College. Within hours, I was registered with a scholarship." Now, it's not just Andy Grove who had that kind of circumstance available to him. Many baby boomers had the benefit of going to college virtually free at that time. And it's hard to see the story of Andy Grove. If Andy Grove were to arrive in the U.S. today, assuming he were let in, it's hard to see his story unfolding in quite the same way. It's possible that he might decide not to even attend college because of the high cost of college, especially if he's arriving as a refugee. Or if he were to attend college, that he would, being saddled with such a huge student debt, that he would make the same choices as he did back then, that he would take the same kinds of risk that he did. And indeed, over the past few decades, we've seen a dismantling of the structures that nurtured a strong middle class. So unionization rates are way down from where they used to be, partly through as a result of concerted attacks on the ability of workers to organize. Our tax code, especially at the federal level, has become a lot less progressive. And both at the federal level and here in Oregon, we have seen a tax code that has become riddled with tax loopholes and subsidies that benefit those most well-off in corporations. Our public structures have weakened. And here in Oregon, we don't need to look very far. We look at our public schools, the state of our public schools, that have been in a state of chronic underfunding since 1990 with the enactment of Measure 5. Now, there's another factor driving income inequality that may not be so obvious, but once you stop and think about it, it does become quite obvious. And that factor is income inequality itself. Income inequality begets more income inequality. And this happens at least on a couple of levels. The first one is that the more income you have left over after paying for all your necessities, the more money you have left to acquire assets, capital-producing assets. So the more income you end up producing. It's a system that sort of keeps growing and growing. So in that way, income inequality begets more income inequality. But there's another way in which it also income inequality fuels more inequality. And that is through the exercise of political power. In our society, money translates into power. And the more income and wealth becomes concentrated at the top, the more those folks are able to use that power to write the rules to further favor them. And it's hard to see the Trump tax plan and some of the provisions in there, such as the call to repeal the estate tax, as anything but the exercise of political power by those at the top. So what can we do here in Oregon to confront income inequality? I think we first of all need to take a step back and recognize that income inequality and wealth inequality are problems of national scope. So ultimately, we do and will need federal action to shrink income inequality down to size, to really create a truly robust and inclusive middle class that leaves no one behind. That said, there is definitely steps that we can take here in Oregon to step up to that defining challenge of our time to confront income inequality. The first thing that we need to do is to live by the principle and ensure that our elected leaders adhere to the principle of first, do no harm. Every legislative session that I've seen here in Oregon since I've been here in the past 10 years, there's been proposals to, in one way or another, lower taxes for those at the top in corporations, be it directly by, for example, lowering the tax on capital gains income or enacting some new tax subsidy or loophole. And this needs to stop. We need to say enough is enough. Lawmakers really need to stop exacerbating the problem of income inequality by giving more benefits to those at the top. The next thing we need to do is we need to enact policies that increase the take-home pay of workers. And there's quite a number of things we can do here in Oregon. About a year and a half ago, we took a decisive step in that direction by enacting a meaningful increase to the minimum wage. And certainly the Oregon Center for Public Policy is proud to have played a role in that victory. But there's a lot more that we can do on that front. Just to give you one example, is enacting a meaningful increase to the Earned Income Tax Credit. The Earned Income Tax Credit, the EITC, is one of the most effective anti-poverty programs out there. It increases the take-home pay of workers through a tax credit. And here in Oregon, we have an Earned Income Tax Credit, but it's really fairly small. So it's really, it would be of great benefit for Oregon to enact a meaningful increase of the EITC. A third strategy that we ought to be pursuing here in Oregon is we need to invest in our people. Pretty much everyone recognizes, at least pays lip service to the idea of education and the importance of education. Frankly, we should be, and they're right in that education is one of the best equalizers out there. It creates economic opportunity. Here in Oregon, we should be investing in creating a top-notch educational system, all the way from early education through college. And I really want to emphasize the point about early education, preschool. The research shows that it's one of the most effective investments any state can make, that it really prepares kids for school. And right now, to our shame, to the shame of Oregon, we have some of the most expensive preschool in the nation. And partly that translates into more than half of kids not having the opportunity to attend preschool before entering kindergarten. And those kids are arriving in school already at a disadvantage to their peers. So we need to invest in our people if we want to create a strong middle class again. Fourth, we need to make the essentials of everyday life more affordable and accessible for folks. We've done a lot of progress in extending health coverage, but there's still the job is not done. And certainly we need to make healthcare more affordable. Transportation is another area. Serious investments in public transportation would make life a lot better for a lot of our folks. And housing is a big area where Oregon really needs to step up. We have a statewide housing crisis. Our elected leaders recognize it. And it's a problem affecting not just urban areas like Eugene. It's a serious problem in rural counties as well. And the Oregon legislature has done far too little to step up to this challenge. There's many Oregonians that spend more than half of their income on housing costs, and they're struggling mightily. And it's really time for the Oregon legislature to step up to this problem. The final point, I've been talking a lot about the kinds of investments that we need to make, and obviously we need to pay for those investments. So we need to raise revenue here in Oregon, and we need to do it in a progressive way. We need to look to those who have benefited most from the economic gains, from those at the top of the income ladder, and corporations to contribute more towards the common good. And I mention corporations because corporate taxes are, by and large, paid by shareholders, by the owners of corporations. And corporate ownership is concentrated at the top of the income ladder. And so corporate taxes are a form of progressive taxation. So let me conclude by saying that there's not that, how to confront income inequality is not that big a mystery from a policy perspective. There's some pretty clear guidelines on what we ought to be doing, the big steps that we can take to confront income inequality. It really boils down to a political problem of making our elected leaders step up to the challenge. And really, if we are going to step up to confronting the defining challenge of our time, we need folks, Oregonians, to once again rise up and demand that our elected leaders confront income inequality in the way that needs to be done. So thank you, and I will be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Now we'll break for about 5 minutes to formulate questions around each table and then return with audience questions. Please remember, only City Club members are allowed to ask questions at the microphone. So if you're not a member and you get so excited that you can't help but ask a question, Clay is right in the back to accept your membership. So thank you. We'll be back in about 5 minutes. Thank you.
This is KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. We're on Facebook and Twitter and online at klcc.org.
Welcome back to the October 27th City Club program, Examining Income Inequality in Oregon. City Club is a nonprofit organization. Support for City Club is provided by our members and supporters, including Sacred Earth Botanicals, U of O Government and Community Relations, and George Rohde Repair Shops. And special thanks to some of our in-kind sponsors, University of Oregon, Academic Extension, Dot Dotson's Photography, and KRVM 91.9 Radio. Before we go to member questions, please remember, keep your questions short and to the point. Thank you. Go ahead, Jerry.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. Don't you think you missed some really big points, like poverty? You didn't mention at all. There's tens of thousands of people in Lane County with zero income, nothing, just some lousy food stamps. There's 10% of our school children are homeless, and you didn't discuss those areas. That's what income inequality has led to. There's no welfare left in the United States. Social Security, which federalized welfare to some extent, is now 2 years behind helping people with disabilities. There's a million people standing in poverty waiting for their first benefits. Last year, 7,400 of those people were dead before the benefits arrived. You missed it.
Thank you for the question comment. I certainly do not mean to minimize the problem of poverty. The Oregon Center for Public Policy has been tracking poverty in Oregon and the working poor for a long time, and it's one of the issues that we work on most deeply. So in terms of its connection to income inequality, certainly one can look at poverty. There's a federal definition of poverty, which is sort of an income limit based on family size. To me, that definition has been wholly inadequate. Because it does not define poverty relative to where the middle is or where the top is as a relative concept. So certainly poverty is a huge problem in our state, just based on the federal definition of poverty. Right now, it's probably somewhere around 15 or 17%. It's a lot of folks in Oregon. Childhood poverty is even higher. A lot of these folks, the majority of folks, are working families. So I definitely do not mean in any way to overlook or minimize the problem of poverty. The reality is that poverty is even worse when one thinks about it in terms of what it actually takes to make ends meet. That threshold is even higher. So thank you for bringing up poverty and making it a part of our conversation today.
Wow, Jerry, I'm surprised that Sandra didn't try to cut you off. My name's Mariah Lehr, now NACPA Awareness Project. This question comes from a guest to City Club. Can you hear me okay? She says, last year's Measure 97 failed largely because the corporations argued it would result in higher prices for consumers. What are your thoughts? Where do we go from here?
Great question, timely question. Yes, from our perspective, it was really unfortunate to see the demise of Measure 97, mostly through as a result of a barrage of negative advertising funded by deep-pocketed interests that spread fear of what it would mean to consumers and misleading advertising. I mean, the reality is that if one thinks about it, if one looks at the history of efforts to address our tax structure here in Oregon, corporations and the business community has long advocated for a sales tax, a direct tax on consumers. And yet, when they were faced with Measure 97, they, in a very clever way, turned around and started portraying this tax as a tax on consumers. The reality is that, as I mentioned in my presentation, corporate taxes are, by and large, paid by corporations, by shareholders, the owners of corporations. And certainly with Measure 97, the way it was structured in a way that it would target the biggest corporations. Now, one can argue whether any piece of it or how much some of it would be passed on to consumers. And academics probably would have been debating that point for years and decades to come. But the reality is that a big part of it, if not the majority of it, would have been paid by the owners of corporations, by the shareholders. Some of it would actually have been paid by the federal government as well. The tax would have been exported through the deduction of corporate taxes here in Oregon. So it was really a misleading argument that unfortunately carried the day in scaring folks into voting against Measure 97. In terms of the way forward, it seems that the effort, Measure 97 was a really ambitious effort to hit for the fences and raise a lot of revenue that we badly need here in Oregon to upgrade our schools and other public services in a big way. I think that the effort of sort of swinging for the fences again may not happen for quite some time. So I think that the way forward is to look for ways of raising revenue in meaningful ways, even if you're not raising $5 billion all at once. But certainly there's good and smart ways that we can raise several hundred millions in things that need to be done. So for example, let me give you one good example. This past legislative session, the legislature discussed ending what one lawmaker called the suits and scrubs tax break. In 2013, during Governor Kitzhaber's term, during the so-called grand bargain, he engineered a provision that lowered the tax rate paid by certain owners of S corporations, partnerships, limited liability companies. They're getting these, so now you have a situation where some very wealthy doctors and very wealthy accountants and lawyers are paying a lower tax rate than their paralegals and assistants. And that tax break is costing north of $200 million. The Oregon House passed a bill to close down that loophole, but sadly it died in committee in the Senate. To me, that's a no-brainer. It's obviously a tax rate, a special consideration for the very rich. So there's a number of mechanisms that we can look to say, raise several hundred million dollars, maybe upwards of 1 point. Another proposal that was floated last session would have been a more modest version of Measure 97 and raised $2 billion for education. So there's plenty of good ideas out there on how to raise revenue. Again, it's mostly a political problem of moving these forward. So we really need to bring pressure to bear on lawmakers to do what needs to be done.
John DeLow, City Club. And I read a while back, somebody, I think it was a senator, congressman from Washington, was thinking about a minimum guaranteed income, not wage, but income for citizens. What is your thoughts on that?
Yeah, the idea of a basic income is being discussed more and more. I think that it's an idea worth considering. But I think it depends on how it's done. I think if it simply eliminates, some folks talk about it as eliminating the entire safety net and replacing it with a basic income. And I think that could end up potentially end up hurting more than it would help, because you would have to make the basic income way higher to really be able to hold folks at the bottom harmless. So I think it is an idea worth discussing, but I think it would need to be, we need to tread carefully at the same time.
Susan Conley, City Club member, thank you so much for coming. Our table wanted to know if you have any ideas as to how citizens could work on inequality through the initiative process. What would be the number one thing we should go after?
Well, that's, I think that tax policy, and I'm sort of hesitant to say it because we have had difficult times at the ballot box with respect to tax policy, but really, when it comes to here, to what we can do here in Oregon, tax policy plays a central role because it is both a way to sort of keep the excess off the top, but also but more importantly, to find revenue to make the investments that we need to make. So I don't have a perfect answer for you as to what we should be doing at the ballot box, but certainly if we can craft a measure out there that would raise significant revenue, it would be worth considering. I think that right now, if one is thinking about the ballot, more we should be thinking defensively, because there's quite a number of threats out there that are already real or very likely to come to pass. Right now, we have a special election, a special ballot measure in January 23rd, I believe, that it is to affirm the health provider assessment that was enacted by the legislature. That is, the failure of that could mean that hundreds of thousands of Oregonians would lose their health coverage. It would undo the progress, some of the progress that we've done in recent years in increasing health coverage. So folks need to be aware of that's gonna be on the ballot. There is some very concerning ballot measures that are petitions at this point, so signatures are being gathered. But one of them, for years, the Oregon Center for Public Policy had been pointing out that the legislature ought to be, based on existing case law, ought to be able to close a tax loophole and subsidy with a simple majority. But the lawyers for the legislature disagreed and had persuaded the legislature that they needed a 3/5 majority to do it. In 2015, the Oregon Supreme Court ruled that no, it only takes a simple majority to close a tax loophole. It's and that opens up opportunities. And so the Oregon Realtors Association and other deep-pocketed interests are floating a petition that would require extend the 3/5 rule to closing tax loopholes. So that's one to be aware of and to fight against and tell people this is just bad policy. Another one would put strict spending caps on the state of Oregon. And this was tried in Colorado in the early 2000s, and it ended up spelling disaster for their schools and for other public services, such that Colorado eventually had to backtrack after a lot of damage. There's a similar idea, a petition that has been put forward. On the positive side, there is potentially going to be a measure that requires corporate disclosure, corporate tax disclosure, of requiring corporations to make public their tax returns, or at least some might give us a good sense of how, what they are or are not paying in taxes for us to be able to make better decisions in improving our tax structure.
Raisa Maddox, City Club member. It seems to me that in 1980 we were in Oregon a heavily manufacturing economy due to the timber industry, and there were many jobs supplied that way. And we've now shifted, I think, more to a service industry. Most of the job growth that we're seeing in our state has been in service industry. Do you have any reflections on how that impacts your area of research?
Sure. Although I should say, and I don't know the exact figures, but Oregon is still, relative to the rest of the country, still have a pretty strong manufacturing base, which is part, a lot of it now in the technology area. But it does make it so that when the economy is booming, Oregon does extremely well. Certainly, one of the issues that comes up when in the discussion of income inequality is the impact of globalization and the outsourcing of jobs. And certainly, I think it's hard to say that that's not part of the story, but I think that that piece of it gets overstated, actually, in the sense that if one compares the U.S. to other advanced countries, they're also subject to the same forces of globalization. They have seen an increase in income inequality, but nowhere near what we have seen here in the U.S. And the reason is because they have taken the steps and had already the structures in place to minimize the ill effects of income inequality. So, yes, I think if I understand your question, it is globalization is a factor, but nowhere near explaining the problem of income inequality.
Thank you for coming today. I'm Paul Thompson, a City Club member. This is a question from one of the individuals in our gallery here. It's an international question. You quoted a statistic that said that 70% of the countries of the world were above the United States in some metric that had to do with measuring income inequality. This individual is interested as whether you have any precedents of countries which used to be below the United States but are now in a more favorable position. And can you tell us what the policies were that were enacted to cause that improvement, and would they be applicable to the United States?
Yes, interesting question. It was Sandy the one that quoted the figures of the Gini coefficient early on. So I'm not sufficiently familiar exactly the ranking of the U.S. in terms of sort of the developing world. I do know that the U.S. in terms of the developed world, the advanced economies, is really at an extreme in terms of income inequality. I'm not aware of any country recently, and unfortunately, that has made a lot of progress in terms of reducing income inequality, but that's not to say that there aren't, because I'm just not fully versed in that aspect of it. Let me just say that from an international perspective, and someone that was grew up in the developing world, I was born in Guatemala and spent most of my childhood there, that in Guatemala is one of the most unequal countries in probably the most unequal or one of the most unequal countries in all of the Americas and in the world. And from what I saw and everything that I know of my native country, it's an economy and a political system that does not function well, where the extremes are so high that it leads to social strife, that it leads to violence, that it's not a pleasant place to live. As beautiful and as much as I love my native country, it's not something that I want to see that happen here in my adopted country and in my adopted home state. So let's just say that if we want to avoid heading into making our current political dysfunction worse, we really need to address income inequality.
Hi, James Barber, Springfield City Club member and candidate for East Lane County Commissioner. Do you see the basic corporate business model exacerbating income inequality as it drives out smaller businesses that typically are invested in the communities they live, pay higher taxes, and have more personal relationships with their workers? And if so, what can we do about it?
Yes, I do think that the current system of huge multinational corporations that control so much of the economy and by extension have so much political power, it is definitely negative, and it's not not good for local communities. And even in the sense that one of the points that we made during the Measure 97 battle was that the profits that corporations make here in Oregon, the multinational corporations make here in Oregon, end up getting shipped outside of the state. So that's money flowing out of Oregon into Wall Street and wherever else it might go, off into a profits get shifted and end up in a tax haven somewhere in some other country, even though they might be here in Oregon. So it's certainly a detriment in that respect. There's a detriment in the sense of what economists would call rent-seeking behavior. When you have companies that are so large, they control such a big portion of the economy, it becomes monopoly power or close to it, and they're able to charge a lot more to consumers and others for what they otherwise would be able to. And that is another driver of income inequality. So, a lot of big companies have also done concerted attacks on workers and their ability to organize. So yes, I would say that concentrated corporate power is a problem and needs to be dealt with.
Thank you. I just want to interject that we do have a reciprocal relationship with Springfield City Club, and we welcome members to come in, but we don't have a reciprocal relationship with political racists or engaging in that. So just to be clear on that, but thank you, James. Good question.
Thank you for coming today and giving us a good talk. My table was wondering about the actual possibility of an expanding lower class, even if you decrease the income equality from the middle class to the upper class, and that due to automation, even if the middle class does start getting more income, won't their numbers recede and the numbers of the lower class increase because of the automation of lower class and middle class jobs?
Yeah, there is a lot of discussion right now as to what, some say the robots are coming to take all our jobs. The fear is actually not just for lower income workers. Actually, there's thoughts that it might replace some workers higher up the wage level. So far, I have not seen any data that it's a big problem yet, although certainly one ought to think about it and be concerned. I think that you're, in some ways, it's sort of the automation and the technology issue that often gets raised in terms of income inequality doesn't really it's such a big effect as I think some people worry about, or some people use the rise of technology to sort of make an excuse for the rise of income inequality, that it's technology that's driving the problem. And if you look at, there's been some very good work done by folks at the Economic Policy Institute that have shown how, and the argument goes something like this, that with the rise of technology, the better educated workers are at a premium in terms of what the wages that they can command. And that's been the driving factor of inequality. And what the folks at the EPI have shown is that answer doesn't really square all that well with reality. Because there's been periods, for example, in the late 1990s, when there was a brief period when wages for those at the bottom, in the middle, and top actually rose in tandem, even though we were in a period of big technological change. And also, in a more recent period, we've seen the wages for highly educated workers, college-educated workers, flatten out. So the technology story doesn't quite explain the rise of income inequality. And ultimately, in my mind, it doesn't explain the vast gap of folks at the very top of the income ladder and the rest. So I'm not sure if it's quite to your point, but the issue of technology and technological progress often comes up in the discussion of income inequality. And I think it's a topic that falls well short of explaining the problem. And furthermore, I mean, ultimately, if robots are coming to take our jobs, I think that the answer becomes, what is our response to it? What systems do we put in place? What sort of safety net do we put in place to address that impact?
Ruth Damler, my table gave me this question. Usually I have my own questions, but this one is saying that with 70% of our people
not having any input in our discussions and our decision-making process, mostly due, they feel, towards gerrymandering. And it really eliminates the decisions being made by the people. Is it time for a revolution?
So we have about 5 more minutes to wrap up questions. So.
I'm not sure if I'm going to call for a revolution this moment right now, but certainly few things would make me happier than to see something like a new Occupy movement rise up and really once again put the issue of income inequality and give it the spotlight that it deserves and put pressure on our political leaders to address the problem. I mean, now they can't make an excuse that they didn't know about it because the evidence is quite clear. And they can't make the excuse that they don't know what ought to be done. Because again, I think it's not a big mystery as to the concrete steps that we can take to address it. It really is a political problem. So certainly I think that if Oregonians, and they ought to be concerned about this and want to do something about it, it's really a matter of putting pressure on your elected officials in whatever way you can to make them address this problem and certainly not make matters worse. So whether it's plugging in locally and at the state level and federal level, we need citizens to be active.
Thank you.
This is Joel Curran, a City Club member since 2012. I'm asking this for one of our guests. What is the compelling case or incentive for the top one half of 1% to want to balance overall income? But before you answer that question, if anybody knows how to incentivize one of the one half or 1% to donate to City Club, talk to me after the program. So the question is, what is the compelling case or incentive for the one half of 1% to want to agree to balance overall income?
Yeah, I think that the incentives are, first of all, one I would say is simply a matter of being a patriot. If you want to see your nation do well, you want to see a nation where everyone does well. And so there's certainly some very wealthy folks out there who hold that view, who believe that it's their patriotic duty to stand up and speak against income inequality and do what they can. There's also an incentive from perhaps just being not wanting to live in a dysfunctional country. Again, I've had the experience of living in a country where inequality is even more extreme than here. And in that situation, we have gated communities here in Oregon and in the U.S. In some countries, they're fully gated off neighborhoods where it's not safe to be outside of places. So just even from that perspective of wanting to live in a place that is nurturing, that is free from violence, where your kids can grow up in that kind of society as opposed to a place where there's chaos and strife, maybe that's an incentive for them. But or simply a sense of justice and fairness. I use this with my nephew and some other kids I know of just saying, you know, if you have a pizza and you divide it into 10 slices, you know, is it fair that I take, 7 out of the 8 slices? And everybody says, no, that's not fair. And so there's an intuitive sense of justice that I think that one can appeal to folks.
So time for one more quick question and answer. Thank you.
I'm Marilyn Milne, City Club member since forever. I am thinking about a sign I saw during Occupy Eugene, and there were good ones, but this one I loved. It said, "Trickle down doesn't." I'd like you to try to help me understand why that myth persists. We see it in ballot measures. We see it in tax cuts. We see it in the current federal budget that's proposed, or the tax plan that's proposed. Why does that appeal, and why do people believe it?
I think that the reason why that myth continues to stick is something that I alluded to earlier, and that is those at the top of the income ladder also control, it's part of a reflection of the concentration of corporate power, control the communications channels. They hold big megaphones, and they They also have an ability to get out the notion, this notion that of a trickle-down approach. And the reality is that it's been shown to be false over and over again. If folks followed what happened in the state of Kansas in the recent years, that's a prime example of trickle-down not working out. The governor came in and slashed income tax rates, even got rid of taxes on pass-through income, sort of for owners of S corporations and partnerships and whatnot. He promised that the Kansas economy was going to boom, but the opposite happened. The Kansas economy began to shrink, or at least not grow as fast as states surrounding it and comparable states. And they found themselves in a situation where state revenues plummeted, so they had to slash spending for schools and for other essential services to such an extent that that Republicans in that state came in and undid those tax changes after a lot of damage had been done. So we've seen that over and over again, where it doesn't harm it. But I think it is ultimately the reason why that myth persists. And I should say again, the Trump tax plan, I think, is another example of that theory being put forward, and again, something that's very dangerous. I think that ultimately the reason why that persists is because of the concentration of economic and political power in the hands of those who would benefit from such a system.
Thank you so much. Before we thank our speaker today, there are a couple of quick announcements. We want to thank Davis Restaurant at 94 West Broadway in downtown for hosting our October City Club Think and Drink just a couple days ago. And we want to thank Frank Lawson, the general manager of eWeb, for coming and spending an hour, hour and a half with folks in an informal setting just to get more issues out there in the community and get some answers and some factual information. And want to say that next week we have a very exciting program on U of O Night Campus for accelerating scientific impact. We're going to have former Senator Chris Edwards, who's the VP of Strategic Initiatives at the university these days, talk about what's going on with the new Night Campus. And more details and any other information about City Club and future programs can be found on cityclubofeugene.org. Now let's give a big thank you and a round of applause to Juan Carlos Ordonez. Thank you. Thank you. That concludes today's program.